Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from Emily O'Grady, who has just won the old Vogel, Australian Vogel Award, with her book The Yellow House. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, these kind of things, big announcement. You've won. There's a whole lot of other writers who haven't won, and there's kind of a bit of an excitement around it. But you've been working on this for a little bit of time. Did you only just get here?
Yeah.
Quickly, been, is it a lifelong?
Yeah, it's been a lot of hard work. I have always been a big reader. I never sort of intended, you know, I never sort of wrote books or, you know, short stories when I was younger. I wanted to work in editing and publishing. So I studied that at university, and halfway through I started sort of getting the idea for this book, and that was about 2010. So, yeah, it's been a pretty long process. Yeah, so eight years.
And so what sparked, when you say you got the idea, you're doing your work, you're studiously working away, and what?
So I have always been fascinated with true crime and serial killers, and, you know, love sort of movies and TV shows about that. And, you know, even in the newspaper, I'd sort of wake up early on Sunday mornings as a 10-year-old and sort of leaf through the paper looking for all these sort of stories about, you know, very extreme, you know, human behaviour. But then in 2010, I think it was, there was quite a high-profile news story where Matthew Malatch, who is Ivan Malatch's grandnephew, murdered his friend in the Blanglo State Forest. And he lured him there on his birthday, and he was caught quite soon afterwards. But in the court documents afterwards, Matthew Malatch was quoted as saying something along the lines of, you know, my family, you know, the last name Malatch, I just did what they do. I did what my family does. And I just found that horrifying and so interesting, and I'd never really considered, you know, the fact that people who are sort of descended from perpetrators have these sort of really unusual narratives as well. Like, you don't really consider them to be victims, and, you know, obviously what Matthew Malatch did was horrible, but, like, he would have had that stigma hanging above his head for his whole life, and he would have just felt this guilt and shame. And I just found it so interesting that, you know, that's not really a narrative I'd really heard before. So obviously The Yellow House is completely fiction, it's not based on that story, but that sort of just sparked that initial idea.
And, you know, as strange as it may seem, but there are people out there who sort of look upon some of these serial killers as kind of weird heroes, or weird, you know, they're at least living, you know, they're doing something where we're just doing nothing.
Yeah.
And at least they're in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's definitely a weird, and I probably am guilty of this as well, especially when I was younger. You know, you think, you know, I'd consume these serial killer, you know, narratives, like Hannibal Lecter is this sort of glorified beast. He seemed, you know, he's really intelligent, he's otherworldly, he's sort of idolized, and it's really, it's bizarre, and they're sort of seen as sort of these modern day sort of monsters. But, you know, the fact that they're human is often sort of forgotten, I think. Like, they are, you know, serial murder is not this sort of sensationalized, you know, sort of dramatic, well, it is dramatic, but it's not, you know, it's very ordinary, I think, and you know, if you are just looking at sort of focusing on serial killers that are sort of glorified, you forget that.
Yeah, and there are people, like, you often hear someone who's a friend of someone who's done something terrible. Yeah, but he's, you know, if you knew him, he's not like that.
Yeah, exactly.
This kind of thing. So I can imagine that a grandson or nephew or the like would look up at, through the mists of, I suppose, there'd be a lot of storytelling about the connection, about that family member, and that storytelling would morph reality, and you'd be getting information from outside of the family and also inside the family, and your loyalty is generally going to go with the family, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a really interesting lens to look at serial murder through, sort of the, you know, the family of the perpetrator to the family of the killer, because obviously they would have had a you know, a relationship with them and would have had this connection, this familial connection, but then on the other hand, intellectually, you know, they did this horrible thing, and it can be quite difficult to sort of rectify the two things.
Okay, so you've got this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Do you rush off to start writing? Does it just percolate there for a few years, or is it, what's the next step to winning your Vogel?
So I sort of wrote kind of little sections here and there. So for a few years, I'd write 1,000 words, write a couple of chapters, and I think I sort of wrote my way into it. So it definitely wasn't this fully formed idea. I didn't really have. I always had the narrator, and that has stayed consistent throughout. But so many other things changed. But I kind of, you know, had written maybe 40,000 words, and then realized this is all rubbish. So I sort of scrapped all of that, started from the beginning, and then sort of wrote pretty consistently for the next couple of years working on it.
40,000 is no small thing. Some people, it's more than a novella and not quite a novel. That's a big thing just to throw away.
Yeah, I think at the time I was probably considering sort of reshaping it, but I just thought, you know, especially if you're a writer, when you start, especially if you start when you're young, you're going to become a better writer as you go along. So what I'd started, the quality of the writing from when I initially started to sort of, you know, the end of that 40,000 was very different. So I didn't feel too bad scrapping it just because it was really bad.
But there's a lot of, people who are writing over a long period of time, especially their first book, that's the trap they fall into. They won't get rid of that 40,000, and they keep trying to make it better.
Yeah.
Instead of just doing what you did and go, look, I've learned so much. The story's not gone. It's over there now.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to start again. Mm-hmm. Seems a smart move.
Yeah.
And a brave move for a young person, a young writer to sort of take on, especially looking at the you know, big chunk of work that is right in front of you. Like it's difficult. Some people get stuck over a paragraph. I can't get rid of that paragraph. You can just toss down 40,000 words.
I think you can't be too precious, I don't think.
Is that the key, do you think, to success in writing? That little bit has to come in? Because I often get, I'll often be shown manuscripts that aren't published, and I'll look through it and I'll suggest cross that, cross this out, cross that, and then it's like,
I've had quite a few readers of this book sort of over the years, and they would give me that sort of feedback, like, this is, cut this, and at first I'd be like, no, that's genius, it's the best sentence I've ever written. Then once you think about it and you sort of percolate over it, then you're like, oh, okay, it's better for the book to get rid of that.
Well, I think that's part of your process that a lot of people don't learn, and it's hard, very hard to teach that.
Yeah.
And that process where you can actually take a step back and go,
I think maybe part of that is that I wouldn't worry too much about the writing as I went. So it was, the first draft was pretty awful. So I sort of knew that just get the first draft out there. It doesn't have to be amazing. And then, you know, later on is when I can really refine the writing itself and the story itself.
Were you writing in isolation, or were you looking at, did you do courses, or did you read any books that sort of gave you help to give you that sort of confidence?
Yeah, so I did a degree in creative and professional writing, so I was sort of surrounded by books and other writers. And I did read or watch a lot of true crime documentaries as well. That was a big thing, and then I would sort of consider that work as well. So
that's sort of more the procedural side of things and how people behave in those circumstances?
Yeah, or even just, what was that one that
even
I watched?
The telling? Is that the way they told it?
Yeah, exactly. So, or even just sort of, you know, it sparks ideas about people's reactions to different sort of crimes. One that I really liked was, but these three boys in sort of the deep south in America, they were put in prison. They were put on death row for the murder of these two young boys. And something in paradise, and they found out it wasn't them after 20 years in jail. So it was this three documentaries, they were like 3 hours each, just this really intensive sort of process, and it was sort of focusing on them and their families. So sort of you're hearing from people who are just sort of generally not considered, I suppose.
So let's go on to The Yellow House. Tell it to me. What is this? Okay. What is this book?
So The Yellow House is set in semi-rural Queensland. It's narrated by a 10-year-old girl called Cub. She lives with her parents, her older brother Cassie, and her twin brother Wally. So they live on an abandoned cattle farm and knackery. And they live kind of close to town, but they're quite isolated from the town. Like, they don't really have any friends. They're not really a part of that community. And Cub has grown up that way. She doesn't really question why. You know, she's close with her family. She just sort of, you know, the world that she lives in just is, she just accepts that that's how things are. So next door to them is the Yellow House. That's just what the children refer to it as, the Yellow House, which was Cub's grandfather's house when he was alive. But he died before Cub was born. And after he died, it was revealed that he had murdered multiple people over the course of his life. But it wasn't until after he died that these crimes were uncovered. A few members of Cub's estranged family move into the Yellow House, and that really sort of sparks the, you know, all these secrets that are bubbling under the surface to start to emerge.
And is that something that bubbling away of past secrets and I suppose the lies we tell each other and the way in which we're trying to smooth over, is that a fascination to you? Like, when looking at some of these documentaries and you've got a killer right looking down the camera at you and they're just telling you something which is completely false, but you look in their eyes and they look like they completely believe it. Is that sort of stuff you like to get into?
Yeah, I think so. The idea of, you know, people can potentially sort of present one version of themselves and then beneath it it's something completely different.
It's definitely a good spot to go hunting for fiction.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Very rich subject matter. Yeah.
And what sort of research did you do? Have you gone up there and driven around areas and or is it some place you know in your brain?
So it's not set on a particular town. Just broadly, it's set in the Lockyer Valley, which is about an hour drive out of Brisbane. So I sort of have family who live a bit further out west, so that's sort of a drive that I've done, you right. know, hundreds of times before.
So you have had time to sort of get there.
Yes.
Yeah. And how important was that to you, the actual landscape and the place?
I think, yeah, super important. So they live on this, you know, this isolated property, and I think that isolation also reflects the fact that they are all isolated from the community. They're sort of just left to their own devices in this quite this beautiful landscape, but also quite a you know, oppressive, stark landscape as well. And I think you know, there's so much space there, but then they are so sort of stifled by these, you know, these secrets and these traumas.
I mean, I've been a suburbanite my whole life. And when I go outside and I go into little big spaces, I get terrified.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't like big open spaces, and yeah. I don't like the bush. The yeah. bush, fine if I'm with the group, but by myself, it just freaks me out.
Yeah.
Is that also another aspect of it? Is that sense of the oppressiveness of, for not everyone, but I'm sure people out there love it, the oppressiveness of that distance and that space that's out there that gives you the scope to...
Yeah, I think so. There is something frightening about, you know, sort of the endlessness of it, I suppose, you know, especially when you consider what had occurred on the property. You know, the people who were killed were sort of taken to this place in the middle of nowhere. There's no way anyone could have heard them. There's no way anyone would have just stumbled upon them. So yeah, it's quite you know, even though it is expansive, it's full of all these like sort of horrors, and I kind of like the idea of that like rural horror as well.
It's always terrified me whenever I see those shows where someone's picked up on the side of the road. There's something on TV the other night, and driven off to an isolated homestead.
Or even when it's in like broad daylight. What's that, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like the original one, where it's all pretty much in the middle of the day, but it's just so frightening because it's just it's cheerfully lit, but then all these, you know, horrible things are happening.
And because you've just won the Vogel and you're a debut author, and you know, people are picking this up for the first time, is it one of those books that just gets bleaker and bleaker and bleaker and bleaker and bleaker, and people are going to be left going at the end of, or there is some kind of light?
I think there is some light to it. I think the fact that it is from the child narrator as well gives a bit of a levity. Like, she is, I mean, it's not a funny book, definitely, but I think there's moments of lightness for sure.
Yeah,
like, you're not just going to be like completely drained at the end, I hope.
Because that's one of those ones where, especially with new authors, you just never really kind of know. And if you're fully involved and you just think, oh my God, don't. And then next step. So thank you.
I mean, I hope so. It's probably one joke in the whole thing.
And when you look back at your own reading, do you think that, I mean, you're reading in true crime. Were you reading those kind of true crime books, or was that mainly on the internet and on video and documentary? Is your normal reading influence the work at all? Yeah.
Not really. I don't think it has. I think it was more so just sort of true crime, like Anne Rule.
Yeah.
You know, a few of those Helen Garner books that she's written more recently, and just sort of TV documentaries and that sort of thing. I mean, in terms of fiction, I probably, you know, like work that is to do with, sort of the extremes of human behaviour and, you know, the aftermath of violence and that sort of thing. Yeah.
This is one of those questions that people who write crime hate, but I'm going to ask anyway because you creep me out. It is like the kind of that the interest in all this stuff, is that because you're quite a nice person normally and you're just trying to get rid of all these evil thoughts? What is it that draws you, like, have you looked into yourself and go, what is it that draws me to the dark?
See, I think especially now there's less of a stigma around sort of liking true crime. You know, there's all these podcasts now.
And they're outing all these weirdos around me.
Exactly. They're everywhere. And I think it's less... I think maybe in the past, the assumption, if you liked true crime, is that you're maybe a little bit creepy because you're sort of enjoying, like, the murder and the torture and the dismemberment of people. But I think the conversation has sort of shifted a little bit. And when you're, with a lot of these podcasts, they're not just focusing on sort of the gratuitous of the crime and how sort of awful it was, but they're looking at sort of, the social, the cultural circumstances surrounding the crime, or they're looking at sort of the victims and the victims' families and sort of the rippling effect of the crime and how that affects sort of so many. I think there's less of a... And, I mean, I think it is interesting because it's, you know, on the one hand, when people sort of commit these crimes, it's incomprehensible and it's so awful and so different to what... you or I hopefully would ever be capable of doing. But then again, you look at the people who commit these crimes and there's so many people saying, oh yeah, he was my mate, he would, you know, I can't believe he did it, and then sort of people can have two sides, and I think that's really interesting as well.
And one thing I'm noticing a lot in that TV drama is the crime is rarely really seen anymore. It's more the ripples through the community around them, or the family that's involved. That is the interesting thing. These people have been going along their normal lives, something traumatic has happened, and they're all asked to sort of, well, it's almost like they almost wake up and then forced to look at life and what is meaningful to them and what is valuable to them in a new way. Is it that part of it as well? Because I'm comforted by your description of of the reasons why people might be interested. And it makes sense that people aren't that interested in the he sliced this and sliced that, but more in how they discovered it and also how it had an effect.
Yeah, for sure. And I think especially when, you know, you really sort of maybe learn, not that I've had an experience, but maybe you learn the most about yourself once you experience these sort of horrible things. So maybe the reason for these movies and TV shows sort of taking that alternate path is that it's just a sort of rich source material for sort of dissecting humanity, pun not intended. So it just...
Not Dexter.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so just using it as a vehicle, as a technique.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my question, because this process has taken so long, 8 years, and I take it the Vogel selection and competition thing takes a long process too, because all the judges have to read so long. Has that given you time? Do you feel like you've been in a vortex of this book, or have you had time to actually step away from this book and start thinking about new projects?
A little bit. So I have started thinking and writing about something new, but it's in the early stages.
Yeah. And would you keep to the sort of the more criminal line?
No. I mean, I feel like they're slightly related, but there's no murder in it. It's set in Scotland, but I think it is sort of to do with, violence and the aftermath of violence and sort of slightly deviant human behaviour.
Well, I mean, for me, those aspects of human nature have always been fascinating. I mean, I'm obsessed with Dostoevsky as a young reader, anything which goes down that line will have my readership, and I think quite a large readership, because there's a lot of people out there who are willing to wander into the darkest regions of the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
thank you so much for coming in, and congratulations on your win. It's an absolute marvellous thing.
Thank you.
And you know, all the best with the future writing, but we are going to make sure everyone reads this.
Great, thank you for having me.
And you can get Emily O'Grady's book at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.